Well, everybody, welcome to class. Welcome to Bio 241. And today is October 1st. We're in the respiration chapter, and we'll probably finish that up today. But let's take a look at where we are with the whole schedule. Today is the 1st. Yep, it's a Thursday. And then next week we're going to start nervous system, and you see there are 3 lectures for nervous system there, so that's a pretty long chapter. Autonomic nervous system isn't very long. And sensory physiology, I'll probably take a couple lectures to get through that. So, chapter 10, sensory physiology, will not be on the next test because it just won't fit. So, what will be on the next test is chapters 4, 5, 7, and 9. And that's on October 20th. And how far away is that? Two and a half weeks away. Is that right? 2.5 weeks away? Two and a half weeks away. Okay, that seems closer than I thought. But we got a couple weekends between there. So the last lecture will be on a Thursday, and then you get the whole weekend to study for the exam. That's nice. I hate it when the exam is on Thursday and I have to lecture on new material on Tuesday and you only get one day to learn it. So, does that ever happen? Yeah, it happens on November 12th. So, study ahead for that, huh? Oh, the final. Sure, the final has to be on a Thursday as well. And we'll have to lecture a little bit on Tuesday. All right. So, we were talking about respiration last time. And does anybody have any questions? Any questions about respiration, what we were talking about? Did you write down any questions as you were studying? So far, so good? Okay. Well, then I guess I have some questions for you as a result. Okay. So remember, this probably is the most important slide that you should know of all of the slides that we're looking at. This is an overview of cell respiration. And I'm going to get my arrow working really, really nice. So I see a person on here, and this person could be in 2 different states. What are the 2 different states this person can be in? A fed state or fasted state. And what state is over here by the liver? Fasted. Nice. And then over here is the fed state. And the liver stores glycogen, and when a certain compound in our blood decreases, then the liver is responsible for maintaining homeostasis of the concentration of that chemical. What chemical is that? I have it on this slide right here. It is glucose. Yeah, blood glucose levels are maintained by liver within, what, a narrow range suitable to support life. So I see where glucose comes from, either a diet or the liver goes into the blood, which is the second row from the top. The third row from the top are things that happen in the cytosol. And maybe you want to say cytoplasm, but cytosol probably would be a better way of thinking about that. And that includes glycolysis. What does lysis mean once again? Breaking down something, breaking down glucose. It snips it in half, basically, into 2 pyruvate molecules, 2 pyruvic molecules, or 2 pyruvate. So how many carbons are in pyruvate or pyruvic acid? Yeah, there are 3, right? And how many are in glucose? There are 6. So if we chop glucose in half, we get 2 3 carbon molecules. That's really nice. All right, and so this can happen under aerobic or anaerobic conditions, but if oxygen is low inside the cell, then there is a relief valve that can operate, and it's called the lactate dehydrogenase reaction. It can convert pyruvic acid into lactic acid. And when I mean release valve, when that happens, it gets rid of pyruvic acid. And because pyruvic acid might force glucose to run in the reverse direction, and it cannot make ATP for us when that happens, right? So pyruvic acid is removed. Converted into lactic acid. Lactic acid can leave the cell and go to other places in our body. And also, the pyruvic acid reaction produces something that's important for glycolysis. It's not on this slide, but probably you should know what that is. The lactate dehydrogenase reaction provides something that glycolysis needs. Not only does it get rid of pyruvic acid, but it also donates something to glycolysis that it needs in order for it to work. And that is, ATP is a pretty good idea, but I have a better idea, a little bit better idea. It is NAD plus, right? So glycolysis needs NAD plus to go in the forward direction to make pyruvic acid. And if that NADH that's produced by glycolysis can't get converted back to NAD plus, then glycolysis is going to stop. That would not be a good thing. So that's what the LDH reaction does. Gets rid of pyruvic acid and it regenerates NAD plus for glycolysis to work. Those are the two important reasons. All right, so that's pretty much everything that we talked about so far. We talked about anaerobic respiration and some of the important other chemical or biochemical pathways that involve pyruvic acid and lactic acid that link skeletal muscle metabolism to liver metabolism, namely the Cori cycle. All right. So, but now what happens if there's oxygen available? What happens to this pyruvic acid? It doesn't get shunted over here into lactic acid, but pyruvic acid then can enter the mitochondria under aerobic conditions. Aerobic conditions. So oxygen is necessary. And if you want to maybe draw something in, here might be something. I know this slide is getting a little bit complicated because I'm telling you to draw stuff in all the time. But put another arrow. All right, since this is aerobic respiration, there's an arrow going to be pointing in to aerobic respiration, and the molecule that is joining aerobic respiration right here is oxygen, right? Oxygen is necessary for this step. Oxygen is not directly responsible for the Krebs cycle or this little arrow here that we're going to call the preparatory reaction, but oxygen is necessary for this electron transport system to work properly. And as a matter of fact, that oxygen is going to be used to make water. So this oxygen in water is actually the oxygen that we breathe inside our body. Kind of funny, it ends up in water, but so it does. All right, so let's talk about some of these biochemical pathways for aerobic respiration. And where does aerobic respiration take place? Inside mitochondria. Nice. Okay. So we're going to flip through glycolysis. Should I recap anything about glycolysis for you? Like how many ATPs are produced for every glucose? There's two. Anything else produced that's a nice energy yielding compound besides glucose? And that is right here, NADH. How many NADHs are produced? One, two. Okay. And there's actually four ATPs produced, but two are used up to get it started, so there's only two ATP produced, right, overall, right, and two NADHs. So don't forget about that NADH. We're going to come back to that in just a little bit. So we talked about all these slides. That brings us to aerobic respiration, and of course, the important compound there that you want to know about, actually just the molecule, that is oxygen. Aerobic respiration starts with that little tiny arrow that was on that slide that we were just talking about. Should I go back and point it out to you? Yeah, it's so good. I should probably put it everywhere in this talk. Here's this little tiny arrow, right? And it's inside the mitochondria under aerobic conditions. This is the preparatory reaction, right? So let's talk about that preparatory reaction first. So here is pyruvic acid. You're familiar with that, right? That's the end product of glycolysis. Here is a coenzyme. We call this coenzyme A. Probably this is one of the first coenzymes that was studied in depth. They could have called it coenzyme 1, but somebody called it coenzyme A. And its job is to combine with pyruvic acid in a special way and also release some high-energy electrons. And in so doing, that causes the decarboxylation of pyruvic acid, right? Because here's that carboxyl or acidic group. This carboxyl group ends up as CO2 in this preparatory reaction. And so if pyruvic acid is decarboxylated, how many carbon molecule is left over? How many carbons are left over in this molecule if it's decarboxylated one time? Yeah, you start off with three, you get rid of one carbon, you're left with two, and that two group is called an acetyl group. So I think you should be familiar with that. Two carbon fragment is going to be called an acetyl group. Maybe some of you have taken some kind of chemistry, a two carbon acid, sometimes called acetic acid, right? So two carbons is always going to have that acetic or acetyl term to it. All right. That two-carbon fragment is bound to coenzyme A, and when it does, we call that acetyl coenzyme A. Acetyl coenzyme A is going to deliver this acetyl group to the Krebs cycle. All right. So what's a good definition of a coenzyme that you should have on the tip of your tongue? What does a coenzyme do? It carries something from one reaction to another reaction, or from a series, from one metabolic pathway to another metabolic pathway. All right, so what coenzyme A does, it carries an acetyl group from glycolysis to the Krebs cycle. All right, so it's carrying that two-carbon fragment. So it really fulfills that definition of a coenzyme very nicely. And it's a big, ugly molecule, so we're not going to look at it, right? It's a big organic compound. We don't have to really be concerned with that. It does have a salt hydro group right here, which is fairly reactive. Maybe that might be interesting for you to know. All right, but it's going to carry an acetyl group to the Krebs cycle. And when acetyl coenzyme A is produced, that takes an NAD+, and it reduces it with some high-energy electrons, producing an NADH molecule. Right, so there are some high-energy electrons in this NADH. And so for every glucose molecule, how many NADHs are produced by this preparatory reaction? Okay, here I see three carbons. I see one pyruvic acid making one NADH. But how many pyruvic acids are made for every glucose molecule? There are two. So for every glucose molecule, how many NADHs are made? There are two NADHs made, and where are these made? Cytosol or an organelle someplace? Inside the mitochondria. Right. It'd be really nice if I could just keep this slide right here for you to look at all the time, because here we are inside the mitochondria. That's what this little arrow represents. So if you have room on your slide, something is coming out of here. Right, and maybe one thing to know is that there is one carbon dioxide coming out. Right, and but another thing that's probably even more important is that NADH. Right, for every one pyruvic acid, one carbon dioxide, one NADH is being produced. And for every glucose, then that would happen twice. Okay, so here's just that preparatory reaction. So that coenzyme A is carrying the acetyl group from glycolysis into what cycle? The Krebs cycle, and hence it is a coenzyme, and it's also because it's a large organic molecule. Okay, sorry about flipping back and forth. Okay, so here's that prep reaction, right? One decarboxylation producing one NADH, high energy electrons right there in that NADH. All right, so acetyl-CoA now is inside the mitochondria. We're familiar with that. Here's that that first carbon dioxide that comes off. Here's that NADH is produced. We're left with that two-carbon fragment. That two-carbon fragment can bind to a metabolite in the Krebs cycle that has four carbons. So if we add a two-carbon molecule to a four-carbon molecule, what do we get? A six-carbon, right? And it just so happens we call this citric acid. I'm not going to ask you to know the names of any of these intermediates, but I will want you to know some overall, what overall happens in the Krebs cycle. All right, so the Krebs cycle is going to turn, right, if we end up with a six carbon, right, after we add acetyl-CoA to it, and then at the end of the Krebs cycle, we have a four carbon molecule, that means that we have to kick out two carbons somewhere in this process, and they're going to get kicked out as a CO2 molecule, just like in the preparatory reaction. And that's going to be a decarboxylation reaction when that happens, just like for this preparatory reaction. Okay, and so this cycle regenerates, right? If we kick out these two carbon dioxides, we end up with oxaloacetic acid, and then that is available to bind another acetyl group from acetyl coenzyme A, and that cycle can turn once again. Okay, let's go back to this slide once again. This is a good time maybe for me to mention it. I said that the most important molecule that we want to be concerned with on this figure is not even on this figure. It's not drawn in. Come on back. Where is it? Where is it? Right here. Okay. The most important chemical that we're concerned about, or a body is concerned about, is not even drawn on this slide right here. And I wanted you to think about that overnight. And some of you had a really good idea before class was over last time, or even at the beginning of class. So we should probably tell everybody right now, if you know, what is not on this slide, which is the most important thing. All right, and it's not the production of lactic acid, not the production of CO2 or water. It's not getting rid of glucose, right? It's not producing high-energy electrons. What's the most important chemical that's being produced by this aerobic and anaerobic respiration that's not on the slide? It is ATP, right? ATP production. So somewhere on the slide, you have to know that going from glucose to pyruvic acid produces to ATP, right? That's the most important thing. Krebs cycle, all right, we're involved with the Krebs cycle right now, so let's go back to Krebs cycle. Here is Krebs cycle. So here's that acetyl coenzyme A binding with oxaloacetic acid, producing citric acid, which is a 6-carbon fragment, and then the Krebs cycle is going to turn. It's going to kick out 2 CO2s at various locations. There's going to be some internal rearrangements of compounds or functional groups on these different compounds, and I'm not going to ask you to know their name, but you should know that the Krebs cycle produces how many CO2s? There are 2, because that's that acetyl group. Where does the Krebs cycle take place? Inside mitochondria, right, and under aerobic conditions. So what organelle produces the CO2 that we have to breathe out of our body? Mitochondria, right? Mitochondria produces that CO2. All right. Not only does it produce CO2, but it produces NADH. What's important about NADH? What is it carrying? High energy electrons. So it is a coenzyme as well, right? It's a big, hairy organic molecule, and it's carrying high energy electrons from one biochemical pathway to another. In this particular case, it's going to carry these electrons from the Krebs cycle to the electron transport chain, which we haven't talked about yet, but we're going to get to that real soon. How many NADHs are produced every time the Krebs cycle turns one time? There are 1, 2, 3. There are 3 NADHs produced for every acetyl group or for every pyruvate. And so how many NADHs are produced in the Krebs cycle for every glucose molecule? Krebs cycle has to turn twice for every glucose, so there are 3 times 2, which is 6, right, for every glucose, but 3 for every acetyl group. Right. Now, you did say 2, but you were probably thinking of CO2. There are 2 CO2s that are produced for every turn of the Krebs cycle. All right, and if we consider the preparatory reaction, that's 3. And if we think of a glucose molecule, then there would be 6 CO2s produced by all of those reactions. FADH2 is an important compound. It's carrying something from one biochemical pathway to another. And what is FADH2 carrying? Just almost like NADH, it's carrying high energy electrons, but not quite as energetic, right? But still some electrons. As the Krebs cycle turns one time, it also produces that compound that we're most interested in, and that is ATP. For every turn, 1 ATP. Directly, the Krebs cycle produces a guanosine triphosphate, but the energy of guanosine triphosphate is almost exactly the same as adenosine triphosphate, so it's easy to convert GTP into an ATP, and so let's just do that right now, right? So the Krebs cycle produces 1 ATP, and that's everything, right? So know that Krebs cycle kicks out 2 CO2s, produces 3 NADHs, produces 1 FADH2, and 1 ATP for one turn of that particular cycle. When ATP is produced as a result of an enzymatic reaction, for instance, when alpha-ketoglutarate gets converted into succinate via this decarboxylation reaction, we call that substrate-level phosphorylation. Substrate-level phosphorylation. And that's the only kind that we've looked at so far, but we're going to look at another kind really soon. And I don't think you can really appreciate substrate-level phosphorylation until we talk about the other kind, but I wanted to at least mention that to you, substrate-level phosphorylation. And that's exactly how ATP is produced by glycolysis. ATP in glycolysis is produced by substrate-level phosphorylation, just like in the Krebs cycle. All right, so that's the Krebs cycle. Under what conditions does the Krebs cycle operate? Under aerobic conditions, because pyruvic acid can't even get inside the mitochondria unless oxygen is present. All right, so we produced all of these CO2s. We got all these NADHs and FADH2s running around inside the cell. And what does respiration really want to produce? Not necessarily NADH or FADH2s. We are interested in ATP. All right, so how are we going to take that energy from NADH and FADH2s and make ATP out of it? That's the goal of these mitochondria. So there's another biochemical pathway that we call electron transport, right? And where are we going to get these electrons from that are going to be transported through these different molecules here? From NADH and FADH2, right? And when that happens, right, we're going to phosphorylate adenosine diphosphate and make ATP out of it. And remember, oxygen is necessary for this to take place. So in this way of making ATP, we call this oxidative phosphorylation. Oxidative phosphorylation is inherently different than substrate-level phosphorylation that we see in glycolysis and the Krebs cycle. Okay, so the electron transport chain is just a series of molecules. Most of these are proteins or modified proteins that are located in the inner membrane of the mitochondria. Remember, mitochondria is a double membrane. It has two membranes. There's an outer and an inner. And the inner is real special because that's where the electron transport chain exists. And it has a special name. What is the name of that inner mitochondrial membrane that has the electron transport chain? It's called the Christie membrane. So that membrane that has all those folds that you see inside a mitochondria, that's the Christie membrane. So there are two spaces also inside the membrane. There's a space that's inside the Christie. We call that the matrix. And then there's a space between the two membranes, and we just call that the intermembrane space. And they're going to be a little bit different. All right, so that's just the overall architecture of a mitochondria. Let's look at electron transport chain. So electrons are going to flow from one molecule to another. NADH is inside the mitochondria. It can donate electrons to a compound we're just going to call FMN. And I don't think I have a question about that, but that's just a compound that accepts some electrons. The important point here is, what state is FMN in? Is it in an oxidized state or a reduced state? It's oxidized because it's going to accept electrons from NADH and it's going to become reduced, right? So FMNH2 is the reduced form of it. And so then what happens to NADH, which is in the reduced form? It gets converted to an oxidized form, which is NAD+. Probably remember that NAD+. Put that plus in there because then that will help you remember there's electrons involved with this. All right, so now we have some electrons in FMNH2. This can donate some electrons to coenzyme Q. And coenzyme Q can exist in an oxidized state or a reduced state. If it's in a reduced state, can it accept these electrons from FMNH2? The answer is no, right? So coenzyme Q has to be in an oxidized state in order to get electrons from FMNH2. And when it does, it becomes reduced. And when it's reduced, it can donate those high-energy electrons to another compound that we call a cytochrome. There are a number of cytochromes within the Christie membrane. And they can flip back and forth from an oxidized to a reduced state as well. Because remember, every time you have a reduction reaction, what also has to happen? Oxidation, because they're coupled together. Okay, so if cytochrome B is never in the oxidized state, can it accept electrons from coenzyme Q? Right, if cytochrome B is only in the reduced state, can it accept electrons from cytochrome Q? And you're telling me no, and that's exactly right. Cytochrome B has to be in an oxidized state to get electrons from coenzyme Q, just like coenzyme Q has to be in an oxidized state to get electrons from FMNH2. Right. And in so doing, then cytochrome B can donate high-energy electrons to cytochrome Cs. There's a couple different kinds of cytochrome Cs. And, of course, cytochrome C has to be in what state in order for electrons to flow into these compounds? They have to be in oxidized state, right? So, fortunately, when electrons move from cytochrome B into cytochrome C, what happens to cytochrome B? It goes from a reduced state to an oxidized state, which means then it can receive electrons from what's in front of it. Right, so all of these things have to work together. So it's just a chain of oxidation reduction reactions, and electrons can only flow through there, right, if the molecule downstream is in an oxidized form. If it's in a reduced form, all of this stuff stops. Right, then cytochrome C and A1 can donate electrons to cytochrome A3 if it is in what kind of state? An oxidized state, right, then cytochrome A3 can become reduced. And when it's reduced, it has some high-energy electrons, and cytochrome A3 eventually gives some electrons, right, to some protons that are inside the matrix and oxygen. This is where oxygen is necessary. Oxygen has to be reduced, okay, molecular oxygen has to be reduced, has to get these electrons from cytochrome A3, and when it does, when it combines with these protons, it then becomes part of a water molecule. All right, so what is the last molecule that is produced by the electron transport chain? It is water, which is kind of strange, right? Because you think of it just as a solvent that we're dissolved in, but it's not. It's a very important metabolite in many kinds of chemical reactions, like what? Hydrolysis reaction, dehydrogenation synthesis reaction, but also oxidative phosphorylation. And if oxygen is not present inside the mitochondria, accepting these electrons from cytochrome A3, can any of these electrons move through the electron transport chain? They're stuck, right? Without oxygen, all these electrons are stuck. They can't move anywhere. And that's a terrible thing because as these electrons are moving from high energy to low energy, as we see on the free energy scale here on the left, what else is being produced? ATP. So if electrons cannot flow through electron transport chain, these ATPs cannot be produced. And how important is ATP in your body? We should consider this for a second. I'm not sure we have in that sufficient detail. Stop me if we've talked about this already. But without oxygen, your brain cannot make ATP. So how long can you maintain consciousness without oxygen? Say your heart stops beating. No new blood is going to the brain. No blood is bringing oxygen to the brain. How long can you maintain consciousness because your brain is using up the ATP and it's not being regenerated? Okay? It is 2 to 3 seconds and you lose consciousness. All right? So your brain needs a lot of ATP. And then, sadly, if oxygen is not restored to your brain is going to die. And after what period of time has your brain used up so much ATP that it can never come back to a living process? It is 2 to 3 minutes, right? So 2 to 3 seconds, you lose consciousness, 2 to 3 minutes, and the brain is dead. That's a catastrophic, irreversible event. There's nothing we can do for anybody's brain, at least with the technology that we know right now. Okay, so that's how important it is. Another way to think of how important ATP is that, let's think of it in terms of your body weight. How much ATP do you need in terms of your body weight? And let's just say that we all weigh about 70 kilograms. That's a typical textbook weight for an average person. Okay. So in terms of that 70 kilograms, how much ATP would somebody need? And you wouldn't know this unless you looked it up or I told you earlier in the class. So I'm just going to tell you to amaze you. And it is more than half your body weight. It's 40 kilograms. A person needs 40 kilograms of ATP every day just to stay alive, right? That's more than half compared to 70 kilograms. So that's how important this oxidative phosphorylation reaction is because it's producing, what? Almost all of that 40 kilograms of ATP that you need every day through electron transport chain, which then tells you how important this oxygen molecule is. The other thing that I see on this slide right here is that for every NADH that donates electrons to the electron transport chain, how many ATPs are produced? I see 1, 2, 3. Right? So for every NADH, it produces 3 ATP. And we said, however, FADH2 has lower energy electrons, so it can't make 3 ATPs. It can only make how many? On this slide, I see 2. This is not an exam figure, but that's a really important ballpark information that you should know. FADH2 can only make 2 ATPs, but NADH can make 3, and that's what we're going to use in this particular class, right? 3 for NADH, 2 for FADH2 inside the mitochondria. These things have to be inside the mitochondria, but remember, there's something that makes NADH outside the mitochondria. What biochemical pathway is that? That is glycolysis. That's right. So the NADH that's outside in the cytosol can enter the mitochondria, but it takes some energy to do that. There's a little bit of an exchange mechanism that converts NADH in the cytosol into FADH2 inside the mitochondria. So NADH that's produced in the cytosol can only make 2 ATP because it can get into the mitochondria only in the form of FADH2. Can't go through the membrane by itself. That's the only other little complicating fact. So here is something that I'm sure you'll enjoy. Your book talks about other kinds of conditions inside the cell. I mentioned under perfect conditions, one NADH can produce 3 ATP. That's under ideal conditions, and a cell might not ever be in an ideal condition. So your textbook likes to say for NADH, it can produce 2.5 ATP. Right? And your book likes to say FADH2 doesn't produce 2, it produces 1.5. Right? Well, that's kind of nitpicky for me. Right? And so I just want you to say for NADH inside the mitochondria, how many ATP? We're not going to be worried about this half or this quarter or this third. Scientists will be discussing and arguing about that for another 100 years or so, but you got to take a test before this 100 years is up. So we're just going to say 1, 2, 3 for NADH, and for FADH, we're going to say not 1.5, not 1.75, not 1.66, right? We're just going to say 2. Make it nice and easy in our calculations, okay? Because those little fractions are not the important point that we want to look at in this class. So this process of making ATP through the electron transport chain is not substrate-level phosphorylation. It requires oxygen, so we call it oxidative phosphorylation, right? So you should know, where does oxidative phosphorylation take place? In mitochondria due to electron transport chain. Where does substrate-level phosphorylation take place? Glycolysis partly, which is in the cytosol, and partly in the Krebs cycle, which is inside the mitochondria. That's a lot of detail. That's enough detail. All right, I'd be happy if you know that. Okay. All right, so that's why we call NAD a coenzyme, FADH a coenzyme, because it's carrying what? High energy electrons from one biochemical pathway to another. And I showed you what these molecules look like. They're big and grotesque molecules, right? They're not simple metal ions. What do we call a simple metal ion that's necessary for enzymatic activity that will turn an enzyme on or off? It's not a coenzyme. It is a cofactor, right? Coenzyme is big, huge organic molecule. Cofactor is just a small metal ion. And a small metal ion could be magnesium, could be calcium, could be iron, could be other kinds, manganese, cobalt. Okay. All right, so the other thing that you see is, according to this energy diagram, when you have electrons going from NADH down here into oxygen to make water, is that an exorganic reaction or an endorganic reaction? It's exorganic, right? Those electrons flowing through ETC is an exorganic pathway. And what does your body like to do with exorganic pathways? It releases energy. By definition, that's what an exorganic pathway is, or chemical reaction is. It releases energy. So what does your body do? Let me ask you a question this way. What does your body do with a biochemical pathway that releases energy? Because it's exergonic. What can your body do with it? It can make ATP, right? So exergonic reactions are necessary to make ATP, because ATP production is what kind of reaction in terms of thermodynamics? Look at ADP down here, ATP up here. It is an endergonic reaction. So these things are coupled together. Exergonic reactions are coupled to ATP production, which is an endergonic reaction. And you saw that with those little gears meshed together on a previous slide. And sometimes that's kind of hard to see. All right, so I've mentioned everything on these slides, except how is ATP made? And it is made with this particular theory in mind, the chemiosmotic theory. There's at least one Nobel Prize that was won by somebody that described what was going on here. All right, so where is the electron transport chain again? Inside the mitochondria. And could I convince you that this is an illustration of a mitochondria? I see one membrane, and then I see another membrane inside of that. So here is an organelle with two membranes, one inside the other. Does that sort of remind you of a mitochondria? And I would hope you would say yes, right? Because there is the outer membrane and the inner membrane. The inner membrane we're going to call the, or is called the Christie membrane. This is the one that's all folded up. And inside the Christie membrane are all of these components of the electron transport chain, plus something else that we're going to call a respiratory assembly. Here's that respiratory assembly. All right, so here are some cytochromes, right? NADH will donate some electrons and then be converted back to NAD+. These electrons can hop from this first compound into the second one right here, and you don't really have to know what these things are called. But as these electrons flow from one compound to another, right, it's going to release some energy. And if it releases energy, it can be used to make something move from high concentration to low, or from low concentration to high. Right, that energy can be used for something. It will be going from low concentration to high, because that's not a passive process, right? High to low is diffusion. But if energy is available, something can go from low concentration to high concentration, and that's something that we call a pump, right? So when electrons flow through this thing right here, it can take protons that are in the matrix, which is that inner space in a membrane, and jam them into this intermembrane space, even though it has a high concentration of protons. Would a proton want to just diffuse into this intermembrane space if it's high concentration here and low in the matrix? It will not want to do that, right? It will need energy of some kind. And it gets that energy by these electrons flowing through parts of the electron transport chain. All right, but it's not just one pump. These electrons flow through another pump, which then are going to jam some more protons in this intermembrane space, making the proton concentration even lower in the matrix and higher in the intermembrane space, right? And of course, going from low to high, does that require energy, or is that passive? Low to high requires energy, and it gets it from these electrons. Here is a third pump. When these electrons flow through this third pump, okay, it can pump even more protons from low concentration to high concentration. That's an active transport process. It gets the energy from the flow of these electrons. And of course, these electrons can only flow through these pumps if these electrons end up where? What has to accept those electrons? Oxygen has to be there, right? Oxygen has to be reduced. It has to get rid of those electrons so they can keep flowing through these pumps. And when oxygen is reduced, it becomes water, right? When molecular oxygen receives those electrons, it produces two waters, or you could say one half of an O2 molecule produces one, right? That's just some chemistry balancing out the reaction. All right, so what are we left with? A very stable condition or unstable condition? When you have high concentration of protons in the intermembrane space and very low in the matrix, is that stable, or will it want to automatically adjust itself somehow? It'll always want to adjust itself so that the concentration of protons is the same across the Christie membrane, okay? And remember, what did we say? What is inherent in a gradient? What does a gradient of something contain? It contains energy. A battery is just a gradient of electrons. We're from a place of high electrons to low electrons. Right here, we have a gradient of protons, and that is a source of energy. And where do these protons want to go? They want to go back down into the matrix. They can't get across the plasma membrane. These pumps right here, right, because the electrons are flowing through them, won't allow that to happen. But then we see this last component of the Christie membrane, or the electron transport chain. This is the tail end of it, and this is what we call a respiratory assembly. These molecules are huge. You can see them. You can't see many molecules with an electron microscope, but we can see these things. And they look like lollipops. The headpiece over here is a little bit bigger compared to the stem of this molecule. And there's a channel in this molecule that allows protons to flow from the intermembrane space into the matrix. And as a proton goes from the intermembrane space to the matrix, how is it going? From high concentration to low, or low to high? It's going from high to low. So when it flows, it's releasing energy that this respiratory assembly is able to use to take an inorganic phosphate and an ADP and make an ATP out of it. So this last step of protons flowing back into the matrix, because it's just dying to get back down into the matrix, that energy is harnessed by this respiratory assembly to make an ATP. Okay, and for every NADH, how many ATPs can be produced? We're going to say 3 by definition. Not shown on this slide right here. How many of these ATP can be produced by an FADH2 molecule? Just 2, right? We're just going to live with that. Okay. For this class, that is fine. You might have to change that if you go on to some other biochemistry classes. All right, so this is what we call the chemiosmotic theory. It has to have a proton gradient across the Christie membrane, and these respiratory assemblies allow protons to flow back in, and as such, that energy can be used to make ATP. And would this be an example of substrate level phosphorylation? Okay. Well, when ATP is produced as a result of a gradient of protons produced by the reduction of oxygen to water, we call that oxidative phosphorylation. Okay, so ATP produced by the ATP synthase in this respiratory assembly is produced by oxidative phosphorylation. So the chemiosmotic theory explains substrate level phosphorylation or oxidative phosphorylation? The chemiosmotic theory is a nice explanation for oxidative phosphorylation, not substrate. Okay, so oxidative phosphorylation takes place in the mitochondria, right? The inner mitochondrial membrane, or across the inner mitochondrial membrane. Substrate level phosphorylation happens in glycolysis or Krebs cycle. All right, well, that's a lot. Hopefully we laid a good enough groundwork with our previous physical chemistry to understand how gradients work and how molecules like to flow back and forth. And if you understand diffusion and active transport and all that kind of stuff, then I've had students say, oh yeah, well, this is obvious. It's not obvious to everybody how this works, right? It took a lot of people a lot of work to see this, and they won Nobel Prizes. So if you don't see it right now, that's okay, because you probably haven't won a Nobel Prize either, like me. Right, so you have to think about it. Yeah, question.
So all three pumps are pretty much they do the same exact thing, other than the last one has.
Oh, okay, this last pump, this one right here? Okay. This thing right here, we don't want to consider that a pump.
Okay, the third.
This third one right here? For this class we're gonna consider all three of these the same. Okay. And yeah, you know what, these are a little bit different. And there might not be exactly 3 of them, but because I want you to know that for NADH it produces 3 ATP, it's great, it's fine with me that there are 3 of these. Okay, because it matches up with that kind of concept. All right. And as I said, scientists are going to be discussing, you know, how many of these are in the membrane and how many electrons flow for probably at least 100 years yet. Okay. So this figure is pretty nice in that respect. And so right here, you could consider, well, this is where FADH2 will donate electrons at this step right here, because there are, what, two of them? So think two ATPs. That's fine with me. Okay. Who's got another question about this chemiosmotic theory? Is anybody not freaking out when they look at this illustration? Do you kind of have a sense of what's going on there? Anybody? Raise your hand maybe if you sort of have a little bit of a sense. Not too many people, okay? Well, have to look at it. This is an exam figure, and maybe that's a good place to start, is just by memorizing that figure, and then hopefully some of that understanding will evolve out of just knowing how to draw this diagram out. Okay, so this is a mitochondria, really, really handy. I do want to tell you something, though. Mitochondria are sort of interesting because it's an organelle that has its own genetic material. It has its own cytoplasm, and it has its own membrane. What do we call something that has genetic material, membrane, and cytoplasm? A cell. That's right. So it's a living cell. You could consider a mitochondria a living cell, and as a matter of fact, it's in control of its replication all by itself. It doesn't need our nucleus to tell it when to divide or multiply. It has its own chromosome by itself. And there is another theory, we call that the endosymbiont theory, that says that this mitochondria at one time was really a bacteria that infected a cell that didn't have mitochondria but did have a nucleus, and they learned to live together under a symbiotic relationship. And so what does a symbiosis mean? Yeah, you have two organisms living together, right? And they both get something out of their living processes. They share some benefits that they can't get all by themselves. They don't have to always live one inside of another. One, in this particular case, this is what's happening in us, right? And so what does the mitochondria get from this symbiotic relationship? What does mitochondria get from our cells? Yeah, it gets oxygen, right? Because we're breathing, right? We're using muscle contraction to get oxygen to all of our cells. So that's important. So we give mitochondria oxygen. What else do we give mitochondria? Well, there are many viruses that predate on bacteria. There are bacteriophages, right? So we have an immune system that protects mitochondria from infection, from viruses. So that's a nice handy thing, right? So it's a nice safe environment for mitochondria to live in, right? And also to make, in order to make ATP, where did all these electrons come from? From glucose, which is something we eat, right? So not only do we give it oxygen, we feed it by giving it compounds like NADH, right? So when we're eating food, we're producing these NADHs indirectly through cellular respiration. All right, so we're giving mitochondria a lot. Sounds like we're giving away the farm. But what do we get out of mitochondria that makes it worthwhile? ATP. That's right. And we got to now compare the difference in how much ATP is produced without mitochondria compared to when they are working, so we can compare aerobic respiration with anaerobic respiration and see if it's really worth all of our effort of eating and breathing just to feed all of these mitochondria, okay? All right, one thing I want to say, mitochondria are a little bit strange because they want to have a high hydrogen ion concentration in this intermembrane space, all right? They just love to have that. And that happens when electrons flow through the electron transport chain. Even though some of those protons flow back down into the matrix, right, there's still enough electrons to pump protons back into the intermembrane space. Remember, when they flow through this respiratory assembly, it makes ATP. But under conditions where there is low oxygen, right, low oxygen, what happens to this electron transport chain? If there's no oxygen here to accept electrons, what happens to that flow of electrons? It stops, right? All right, and if these electrons stop flowing, what about these pumps that are pumping protons into the intermembrane space? They stop as well. But what does that mitochondria love? It loves to have a high hydrogen ion concentration in this intermembrane space. If these pumps are not working, mitochondria have figured out a way to do that. And that is, these respiratory assemblies can work in the opposite direction. Instead of letting protons flow from the intermembrane space to the matrix, they can turn into a pump, taking protons from the matrix and putting it into the intermembrane space. But when that happens, what else has to work in reverse? ATP is being used up instead of being provided. Right? So when a cell is operating under anaerobic conditions, the mitochondria are no longer our friends. They're actually what? They're actually hurting us because they're actually gobbling up ATP. And that might be a really important clinical concept at some point in time when somebody has a blockage of a blood vessel, blood can't get to the brain. It would be really nice in that particular condition to turn these mitochondria off so that they don't use up ATP. Nobody knows how to do that yet, but you should be able to think forward and backwards here. Okay? Okay, so that's pretty interesting. All right, so we talked about the function of oxygen and all that kind of stuff. We talked about direct versus oxidative phosphorylation or substrate level. That's usually how I talk about it. Here's a nice synopsis of what's happening. All right, for substrate level, we got what, 2 in glycolysis. We have 2 in the Krebs cycle, because remember the Krebs cycle has to turn twice for every glucose. All right, so there are 4, but for oxidative phosphorylation, there are many. There's about 30 ATP produced, right? And so we want to take a look at how that happens. Okay, I think I'm just going to... So here is a good slide. I don't know if I made this slide or if it was in the book, but I like it, right? 3 ATPs for every NADH, 2 ATPs for every FADH2. And so for electron transport, that's going to give you a net of 26 ATPs. What about for anaerobic respiration? How many ATPs are produced by anaerobic respiration? It's glycolysis, it's 2, right? So it's 2 versus 26 in this sense. But we want to add together all of the ATPs together. So here is a table that describes that to you. I think I only want you, this is not an exam figure or anything, but you should probably work through it. Right, and I see 1.5, 2.5, 2.5, and for us in this class, we want to convert this 1.5 to 2, right? This 2.5 to 3, just to make it nice and easy. So let's compare some of these pathways. Glucose to pyruvate, you know what that's called. What is that called? Glucose to pyruvate, that is glycolysis. And how many ATPs does that produce? And that too, you've seen that already. That's pretty nice. All right, but that's not all it produces. It produces NADH, right? And it produces 2 of them for every glucose. But remember, when NADH is in the cytosol, it has to get into the mitochondria to give those electrons away to electron transport, and that takes a little energy to get across the mitochondrial membrane. So NADH in the cytosol gets converted into 2 FADH2s in the matrix of the mitochondria. Right, so think of the coenzymes that are the reduced coenzymes in glycolysis actually producing FADH2 because it's in the cytosol. All right, so how many ATP then are going to be produced by these 2 FADHs? Well, how many ATPs for every FADH? Put 2 right here. All right, and then how many FADH2s are produced for every glucose? There are 2, right? And so that's 2 times 3. 2 times 2, right? There should be a 2 here. 2 times 2 is 4. This table isn't far off. Okay? You could memorize these numbers or go with 2 right here instead of 1.5. It changes things just a little bit. All right, what about the preparatory reaction? Pyruvate 2, acetyl-CoA. Does it produce any ATP? No substrate level phosphorylation, like in glycolysis. But it does produce NADH, and it is inside the mitochondria. So guess what? It doesn't have to be converted into FADH2, right? And there are 2 for every glucose, right? And so we have 2 for every glucose, but how many ATP for every NADH? You just want to say 3. So 2 times 3 is 6. Change that just a little bit. All right, now we got the Krebs cycle. And here we have Krebs cycle does have substrate level phosphorylation. That's this column right here, direct phosphorylation. For every turn, it produces one ATP, but for every glucose, how many times does Krebs turn? Twice, so that's two ATP. If we add this column up, we're ready to add this up. So for substrate level or direct phosphorylation, how many ATP are produced for every glucose? I see four. Okay, four. And that's under aerobic conditions, right? Because Krebs cycle doesn't work under anaerobic conditions. If this was anaerobic conditions, how many ATPs would be produced? Only through glycolysis, which would be two, would be even worse, right? A measly two. All right, so let's go back to that prep reaction. We finished that already, right? Prep reaction makes one NADH, it happens twice, and there's going to be three ATPs times two, there's going to be six. Krebs cycle. We're done with that ATP. Krebs cycle makes three NADH and one FADH2 for every turn. And how many turns does the Krebs cycle go through for every glucose? Twice. That's this two right here. All right, so NADH times these three, right? And so three NADHs, that's this three right here. So how many ATPs are produced for each one of these? Are three, right? So that's going to be three times three, or nine, instead of 7.5. And then for FADH2, right? You got two of those made for every glucose, two turns of the Krebs cycle. How many ATPs are produced there? Well, it's going to be two of these FADH2s times two, and you're going to put a four right here. Okay. All right, so if you add all of these things up, for aerobic respiration, right, according to this table, you get 30, right? But we know it's a little bit more because we're thinking of ideal conditions, so it's going to be 30-something. The question here is, how many ATP are produced by aerobic respiration? Made by substrate level plus oxidative phosphorylation, it's going to be, the correct answer for me is going to be 30-something, right? And I don't really care if it's 31 or 32 or 33 and a half or 34 and a third or 36. These numbers are all what? 30-something by aerobic respiration. Okay. And how many are made by anaerobic respiration, which means only glycolysis, are two. So what are you comparing? Production of two ATP versus 30-something, which is better? Which is more? 30-something or two? 30-something is a lot better. That's one of those commercials, right? What's better, this or that? Well, 30-something, right? So oxidative phosphorylation or aerobic respiration produces way more ATP. And there are some organs, when they operate anaerobically and can only make two ATP for glucose, they can't stay alive, like the brain, because they need way too much ATP. Kidneys, another example. Your heart can't stay alive. Some organs can, all right, but you can't live without a heart or a brain, so that doesn't do us much good, right? All right, so that's what I want you to see on this particular table. So we're done with that discussion. We're done with aerobic and anaerobic respiration, and what's the point, what's the whole point of this slide at the very beginning once again? Right here, that's why it's such an important slide, right there is, it produces ATP. And you should have a sense of where these ATP come from, maybe have a sense of where these CO2 come out, right? And you should know where these things happen in the mitochondria or cytosol. And not really part of this chapter right here, but it's important. What is necessary for this glucose to go from blood into the cell? What has to happen? There has to be a signal. There has to be a passport floating around. There has to be insulin. That's right. Without insulin, this glucose is trapped in the blood, right? And that's why we know that people with uncontrolled diabetes, their blood glucose is just sky high because glucose can't get into the cell. And if glucose can't get into the cell, what can you tell me about glycolysis? Not working. What about Krebs cycle? It's got oxygen, but it can't work. Oxidative phosphorylation. So these cells are basically starving to death, right, when somebody has uncontrolled diabetes. And we know some organs that are affected the most. Those are the ones that require a lot of ATP, like brain, kidney, okay, for instance. Those are all things that are devastated with uncontrolled diabetes. Okay, because the cells are just starving to death as a result. All right, so we got another class of compounds. We're not going to talk about proteins much in this class, but we are going to talk about fat a little bit, fat metabolism. There is, for a certain weight of compound, right, if we're going to look at the same weight of fat compared to the same weight of carbohydrate, there's a lot more energy in fat than there is in a carbohydrate for the same weight. There's more than twice as much energy in fat compared to sugars, and the same for protein. Sugars and protein have about the same amount of energy per gram, but fat is about twice as of that. All right, and we know something about fats. How about a triglyceride? What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? A glycerol, which you know a lot about. You know what it looks like. You know how to calculate molecular weight. And three fatty acids, and you know what a fatty acid looks like. Really long hydrocarbon chains, right? And it could be saturated or unsaturated. That probably doesn't matter too much. All right, so how are fats? We're just going to consider fats. How do we get energy out of fats? Well, what I see right here, I see glycogen, and then I see something that looks a lot like glycolysis, and I like that. And so you should know what these arrows are up here, like glycogen going to glucose. Whoa, blast from the past. What's that called? Glycogen going to glucose. That is glycogenolysis, right? And then I see glucose being incorporated into glycogen. That is what? Wow, I forgot. Glycogenesis, yeah, glycogenesis, right? And glycogenolysis, that's nice. Then here we have glycolysis going in this direction. What do we have going in the reverse direction? That is gluconeogenesis going in the reverse direction. And you know that all of these compounds here have six carbons, okay? But this one here and pyruvic acid don't have six, they have three. Okay, because that glucose has been chopped in half. And how many carbons are in glycerol? There are three, so that's handy. So for every glucose, how many glycerol can your body make? Can make two, right? Okay. All right, and we know glycerol is a building block of fat as long as we have fatty acids. And so taking glycerol and fatty acids, joining them together, producing a triglyceride, what kind of reaction do we call that? Dehydration synthesis reaction. All right, the reverse reaction can take place. What do we call that? A hydrolysis reaction. The reverse reaction is controlled by an enzyme called lipase. All right, and that process of taking a triglyceride and making its building blocks, which is glycerol and three fatty acids, if you want to draw three in there, that's fine. All right, going from a triglyceride to glycerol and three fatty acids, we call that lipolysis. Lipolysis. Lipolysis is the breakdown of a triglyceride into these building blocks. And it doesn't release energy, right? But we do have a lot of energy in these fatty acids. How is our body going to get energy out of a fatty acid? Well, these have many, many, many carbons. The fatty acid is broken down two carbons at a time. And what is a two-carbon fragment called that we're kind of familiar with? An acetyl group, and there is a coenzyme that can carry these acetyl groups from fatty acids into the Krebs cycle, and that is what? Coenzyme A. So fatty acids can be used to generate two carbon or acetyl groups that can be put into Krebs cycle. And what do you get out of the Krebs cycle when it gets acetyl-CoA? Yeah, you get a lot of ATP, right? Three NADHs, one FADH2, and one ATP for every turn, right? So for every two carbons that come out of a fatty acid, right, you get all of those NADHs and FADH2s. And then how many two-carbon fragments do we get out of a fatty acid? A lot, right? Like maybe 7 or 8, 10, right? So it can make a lot of ATP. And don't forget, those NADHs even make more ATP when those electrons go through through the electron transport chain. So that's why there's so much energy in these fatty acids. All right, so I want you to remember this acetyl group has two carbons, and fatty acids are broken down two at a time. Going from fat to fatty acids is lipolysis. Going from a fatty acid to acetyl-CoA is another kind of biochemical pathway that you're going to learn a little bit about, and that's called beta oxidation. Beta oxidation. because it's not the very last terminal carbon that's being oxidized, it's the one that's next to that. We call that the beta position. That's where that beta comes from. All right, so fat to glycerol fatty acids, what do we call this process right here? It's going in this direction. That is lipolysis, going from fatty acids to acetyl-CoA. We call that beta oxidation. Well, what does beta oxidation need to take place? It needs oxygen, right? That's part of the name. So that happens under aerobic conditions as well. And for sure we know Krebs cycle works under aerobic conditions, and that's it. All right, so we see that acetyl-CoA is in a crossroads between many kinds of compounds. How many carbons do we have in this acetyl group? There are two, right? And how many are in pyruvate? Three. Ooh, those molecules are really different from each other. One has two, one has three. So acetyl-CoA can participate in other chemicals that are some combination of two carbons, but never a combination of three carbons. Right? So on a slide, the previous slide, it says acetyl-CoA can be interconverted into proteins and sugars and fats, and that's not really true. Acetyl-CoA can only be converted into things that are fat, like fatty acids, right? Because if you put two acetyl groups together, can you get a pyruvate molecule, pyruvate? You cannot, right? You can only get something with multiples of two. And so acetyl-CoA can be used to make fatty acids. We can take these two carbons together and, right, and make some fatty acids out of them. And a fatty acid you can make a triglyceride with, as long as you have glycerol from another source, or phospholipids. Acetyl-CoA can be converted into citric acid, right, and then can be decarboxylated via the Krebs cycle. So this will produce energy. So if a cell is low on energy, it can produce energy through the Krebs cycle. If it's high on energy, this acetyl group can be saved for another day in the form of a fatty acid. Or maybe this acetyl group can be used to make other lipids like cholesterol. Now, here we have that acetyl-CoA. To make a fatty acid, okay, what do we need? Here we have a fatty acid. To make a triglyceride, you need more than a fatty acid. What do you need? You need glycerol. And acetyl group is a two-carbon fragment. How many are in glycerol? Three, right? So where does this three-carbon fragment come from? It doesn't come from fatty acids or this acetyl group. It comes from glucose, right? It's a glycolytic intermediate. And when somebody doesn't have glucose in their diet, or glucose can't get inside of a cell, a person's body doesn't have any glycerol. And as such, right, it can't make triglycerides. And as such, then there aren't intermediates for the Krebs cycle, right? So when you have this acetyl group, it can be converted into cholesterol, or it can be converted into what we call a ketone body. So ketone bodies are combinations of two acetyl groups or four carbons that makes a little bit of energy for a cell, but not very much. Okay. And remember, that ketone body, a good example would be acetone, and that's very volatile. You can smell that on somebody who is diabetic or somebody that has severely restricted carbohydrate intake. Like if they're on a really low carbohydrate diet, okay, then they don't have the intermediates for the Krebs cycle, and this acetyl-CoA is converted into ketone bodies. So that's sort of interesting. What kind of diet is that, where somebody restricts their carbohydrates? I don't know if it used to be really fashionable. It's very effective, but how about Atkins diet? Does that ring a bell to you guys anymore? Atkins diet? No. It used to be a really popular diet. Atkins diet, you didn't eat any carbohydrates, right? And with no carbohydrates, the citric acid cycle couldn't work. Fatty acids were converted into acetyl-CoA, but that acetyl-CoA couldn't go into the Krebs cycle, producing a lot of ATP. The only fate for this acetyl-CoA would be to make ketone bodies. And what do we do with ketone bodies in our body? We breathe ketone bodies out when we exhale. So Atkins' diet was really amazing and fascinating because if a person restricted their carbohydrate intake, all of this fat in their body, like triglycerides and fatty acids, they would do what? They would just breathe right outside of their body. That's wonderful, right? And it is wonderful. But what's the trade-off? What is not happening when you're breathing all of this fat out of your body without exercise, just by normal everyday activities? You're breathing these fats, triglycerides out of your body in the form of ketone bodies. But what is not happening if you don't have sugar? You don't have the Krebs cycle working. And what's the importance of the Krebs cycle? It makes ATP, right? So when somebody was on a really restricted carbohydrate diet, their cells were starving for glucose, and somebody would get really dingy because they wouldn't have a lot of ATP. They would see a red light but not recognize it as a red light, drive right through, show up for a physiology test and have a calculator right next to them but not even know that they need a calculator to answer that question. So on that Atkins diet, all right, it's kind of fallen out of favor because of that. But if you're doing any kind of drastic dietary manipulations, you should be working with a dietitian that knows some of these subtleties of the biochemistry of what can happen to you. So hopefully nobody's on an Atkins diet in this class right now, right? Because you just aren't making enough ATP to get through the class. Okay, so this is sort of interesting. I don't see an arrow going from acetyl-CoA to sugar anywhere. It cannot happen. Right? And so in order for you to burn acetyl-CoA with a Krebs cycle, you need to have some carbohydrate in your diet. You need to have some sugar for that to happen. Okay. So we talked about lipolysis. You know where that was. Here is beta-oxidation. I think this is the last slide for today. Beta-oxidation. Let's take a look at that. Here we have a fatty acid. Can you remember what a fatty acid looks like? Big, huge, long hydrocarbon chain, right? Carbon, 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 it goes carbon, 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 and they're all hydrogens on either side, no other functional groups. A fatty acid does have one carboxylic acid on the end, one carboxylic acid group, and that's what a coenzyme A can bind to, right? So with some enzymes inside the body, coenzyme A binds to that carboxylic group that makes this bond between the alpha and beta carbon reactable, and there's some rearrangements of some electrons, and then finally it cleaves at that location to make what's a two-carbon fragment called? Acetyl. That's an acetyl group bound to coenzyme A. So here's an acetyl coenzyme A. What happened to the length of this initial fatty acid? It got shorter by two carbons, right? So that's what we call beta oxidation, when a fatty acid is broken down two carbon fragments at a time to make an acetyl group. And when that happens, what is produced by just beta oxidation by itself? Some FADH is produced, and some NADH is produced as well. And through electron transport, this FADH2 and NADH can make ATP. So beta oxidation can make ATP. And we're going to say what? We're going to say 2 and 3 for every time this happens one time, there are 5 that are produced, right? 3 and 2. It takes 1 to get the process started. Some ATP is used just like in glycolysis, so there are really 4. But that doesn't tell you how many ATP are produced by this acetyl-CoA, right? So where does this acetyl-CoA go? Into the Krebs cycle, and then that can make a whole lot more ATP, namely 2. All right, so this is why a lot of energy is stored in a fatty acid, because beta oxidation produces ATP, and the end product of beta oxidation, namely this acetyl-CoA, can even produce more ATP when it gets into the Krebs cycle, and it keeps the electron transport chain working. And the last thing I want you to know is where beta oxidation takes place. It takes place in mitochondria as well. Does it say that on this slide? You knew that. That's nice. Okay. That happens inside mitochondria. And the Krebs cycle is inside the mitochondria. And coenzyme A is necessary for beta oxidation. But I think the important thing to remember here is that a fatty acid is broken down just two carbons at a time. And these two carbons can never end up back into the reverse of glycolysis making sugar again. What do we call the reverse of glycolysis? That is gluconeogenesis. That's right. This two-carbon fragment can never be used for gluconeogenesis. It can be used to make ATP, or it can be used to make fats. That's basically about it. And then there's one last thing. Okay, here is a compound. And we have a hydrogen here, OH, a hydrogen, hydrogen, hydrogen. I'm going to turn a light on in a second. That's a favorite molecule for a lot of people. What is that? Can anybody recognize that? You'd have to be, maybe take an organic chemistry class or something. Okay, this OH makes this an alcohol. And this two-carbon alcohol is called ethanol. And what do you know about ethanol? That's the active ingredient in adult beverage, right? That's what intoxicates us. So that's a kind of a toxic compound. And how many carbons do you see? Two. What can you tell me about this molecule right here? We can break it down, right, and put this acetyl group into the Krebs cycle and get energy out of it. But if our body has enough energy, it's going to store this thing. Can it store it as a sugar molecule? Can we make a sugar out of ethanol? How many, like glucose, how many carbons does glucose have? It's got six, right? And in order to get six, it's got to put two, three carbon molecules together. It can't put three of these. It's got to have two, three carbons. And you can never make a three carbon molecule out of one that has only two in our bodies. All right, so this thing right here can never be converted into a sugar molecule, but what can this be? What is this a building block for? I think I have it on one of these slides right over here. What is this two-carbon fragment a building block for? Acetyl-CoA, you can make a fatty acid out of it. All right? So when we drink adult beverage, it's like drinking fat because that's really the only thing that we can do with it. When we have adult beverage, it's like eating a bar of butter, because ethanol is only a two-carbon fragment, right? Unless you exercise heavily, right, then, of course, you can make ATP out of this thing, but we don't always need that caloric intake. That happens in the liver. The conversion of ethyl alcohol into fatty acids happens in the liver, and after an evening of serious drinking, our liver looks fatty. If you were to look at it, there's just fat all over the place. And if somebody drinks alcohol every day, guess what happens to the liver? It turns into what we call a fatty liver. It's just loaded with fat. And then that can turn into something else. That turns into liver cirrhosis. And liver cirrhosis can turn into something else. And that is liver cancer. Okay, so that ethyl alcohol is really a fairly dangerous kind of compound. And I think I've known people to drink themselves to death just by drinking about four beers every day, if you do it consistently. Some people can live okay like that, but most can't. Okay. So it's just something, the nature of that two-carbon molecule. Okay, that's it. Sign-in sheet is going around someplace.